VOA News, I'm Tommy McNeil. The U.S. is trying to build a case that Iran was behind this weekend's attack on key Saudi oil facilities. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports from the White House.
Iran denies it, but American officials have released satellite photos suggesting the attack came from either Iran or Iraq. A Saudi military spokesman later said Iranian weapons were used. The incident has sent energy prices spiraling and raised new war fears. President Trump says if a response is needed, the U.S. is locked and loaded. Vice President Pence's chief of staff, Mark Short, is downplaying talk of imminent military action, though, saying locked and loaded is a broad term.
It's a reflection that this administration has advanced policies that make sure America is safer from these sorts of oil shocks.
The attack stopped production of more than half Saudi Arabia's daily global oil exports. Sagar Magani at the White House.
Members of the United Auto Workers Union are on strike against General Motors as the two sides remain far apart on the terms of a new contract. AP's Rita Foley reports on what the strike means for car buyers.
Experts say GM has enough vehicles on dealer lots to last about 77 days. That's well above the industry average. But the number of available Chevy Tahoes and Suburbans, the big SUVs that generate the big money, are well below the industry average, they say. A strike means GM isn't making vehicles or parts in the U.S., and probably not in Canada or Mexico either. Bottom line, a lingering strike means down the road there'll be fewer vehicles for consumers to choose from on dealer lots. I'm Rita Foley.
And the union wants better wages and health care, as well as job security and profit sharing. This is VOA News. Purdue Pharma, the maker of prescription painkiller OxyContin, has filed for bankruptcy protection in a U.S. court. The company is facing numerous lawsuits from local and state governments and other plaintiffs alleging it aggressively marketed dangerous addictive painkillers that helped fuel the opioid crisis in the United States. AP's Julie Walker.
The bankruptcy filing comes after Purdue Pharma reached a tentative settlement, which could be worth up to $12 billion over time, with many of the more than 2,000 local and state governments across the country that are suing the company over its role in the opioid crisis. But the holdouts include more than half the states, and some of them are expected to object to the settlement in bankruptcy court and continue their lawsuits against the Sackler family, which owns the company. I'm Julie Walker.
Korea's U.S. nuclear talks ahead. North Korea says that the U.S. could resume with the talks in a few weeks. VOA's Jeff Custer.
North Korea says the fresh talks could happen, but it will not consider abandoning its nuclear weapons unless external threats are fully removed. The North adds any upcoming working-level meetings will be decisive in determining the fate of the negotiations have stalled since a February summit between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and President Donald Trump in Vietnam collapsed over disagreements regarding sanctions relief in exchange for disarmament measures. Jeff Custer, VOA News.
Hundreds of medical staff at one of Hong Kong's main public hospitals rallied Monday to support months of protests for democratic reforms. This comes after new violence over the weekend rocked the semi-autonomous Chinese territory. Staff at the Prince of Wales Hospital formed the human chain, urging the government to resolve the conflict by acceding to protesters' demands. They include direct talks and elections for the city's leader and police accountability. The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and the European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker actually held their first face-to-face talks on Monday, though not the EU that a deal is in sight. The European Commission says that Britain has yet to offer any legally operational solutions to the issue of the Irish border, which is the main roadblock to a deal. China's vice finance minister will lead a delegation to visit the United States on Wednesday for trade talks. That's according to China's commerce ministry. The visit by Lao Min will pave the way for the China-U.S. high-level economic and trade consultations in October in Washington, it said. The talks are aimed at resolving a bitter trade war that dragged on for over a year and hurt global growth. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
We'll be right back. Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Tuesday, September 17th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Uganda and Rwanda take further steps to ease tensions between them.
We have nothing to benefit in destabilizing Rwanda. We are going to be investigating all these allegations and counter-allegations, and we shall find a way of resolving them.
Sam Kutesa is Uganda's foreign affairs minister. Opposition politicians and rights activists welcome U.S. sanctions on former Ugandan Inspector General of Police Kale Kayihura. Botswana's main opposition party rejects calls for all party to sign a peace agreement before the October 23rd election. Liberia's vice president wants more women representation in parliament. And South Sudan's SPLA-IO rebels deny new recruitment of child soldiers.
I can speak from a political perspective and tell you that we don't have a policy as a movement to recruit child soldiers.
Mabio Garan Dibmabio is chairman of the SPLM-IO Committee for Public Affairs. And Sierra Leone's president announces measures to curtail school examination cheating. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Rwanda and Uganda on Monday took further steps to resolve the disputes that have affected their bilateral relations in the past month. Among other measures, the two countries agreed to cease hostile propaganda in all media. As Yuji Uwimana reports from Kigali, they made their declarations at the conclusion of the first ad hoc commission meeting.
According to the Rwandan government, our thorny issues would be removed if peace talks continue on successful track. Olivier Nduhungirehe, Rwanda's Minister of State in charge of East African Community in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, says the historical bond between Rwanda and Uganda should be a pillar of good relations in the region.
Rwanda and Uganda share historical ties that should normally build a strong strategic alliance given the long-standing bonds linking the two peoples and countries.
However, the Rwandan government did not say what would become of the travel advisory it issued, discouraging Rwandans from going into Uganda. This issue has been a bone of contention for Rwanda. Sam Kutesa, Uganda's Minister of Foreign Affairs, says due process will be followed in dealing with citizens from both countries.
We are going to use the courts, we are going to use the DPP, we are going to use all the formal ways of dealing with people who are alleged criminals or allegedly detained so that we distinguish the innocent from the guilty.
Rwanda had also accused Uganda of hosting and supporting rebel groups trying to destabilize the Kigali government. Minister Kutesa said his government does not have any interest in destabilizing Rwanda's security.
We have nothing to benefit in destabilizing Rwanda, just like I think we have nothing to benefit by destabilizing Uganda. We are going to be investigating all these allegations and counter-allegations, and we shall find a way of resolving them.
The convening of the ad hoc commission in Kigali was the first meeting to follow up on the implementation on the MOU signed last month in the Angolan capital, Rwanda. Manuel Domingos Augusto, Angola's Minister of External Relations, said the meeting in Angola represents Africa's way of finding African solutions to problems on the continent.
This is a very positive sign and is also a proof that we all believe that we can find African solutions for African problems.
The Luanda Memorandum of Understanding between Rwanda and Uganda was signed on August 21st. In a communique issued Monday, both Uganda and Rwanda agreed to finalize the extradition treaty in order to provide a framework for the future exchange of criminal fugitives. The next meeting will be held in Kampala in 30 days to review the progress in the implementation of the Luanda Memorandum of Understanding. Eugene Wimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
Opposition politicians and human rights activists in Uganda say they welcome U.S. sanctions on former Ugandan Inspector General of Police Kale Kayihura. They say the sanctions should serve as an example to other government and military officials not to violate human rights. Last week, the U.S. imposed travel and financial sanctions on General Kayihura for human rights violation, but the former police chief said the allegations are baseless, unverified, and outrageous. Mugumi Davis Raikariji reports from Kampala.
The U.S. government sanctioned Kaihura for having engaged in serious human rights abuses against Uganda citizens, as well as for his involvement in corruption practices. Kaihura's lawyer, Jeth Tumwebaze, says the allegations are ridiculous. Tumwebaze says it is unjust to sanction both the general and his relatives.
These sanctions are disturbing. They are malicious, they are unfounded, they hold no water.
The number one tenet of the judicial system all over the civilized world is that you must give somebody a right to be heard. These allegations should have first been put to Kale, to General Kale, so that he is able to respond. General Kale has been elevated by the Americans to the level of Hitler. You cannot condemn his wife and children. What have they done?
Section 70.31c of the U.S. law provides that in cases where there is credible information that foreign officials have been involved in significant corruption or gross violation of human rights, those individuals and their immediate family members are ineligible for entry into the United States. Kampala lawyer and politician Erias Lukwago applauded the U.S. Department of State for sanctioning the former police head.
We believe the only way of dealing with impunity, which has taken a root within the border politic in this country, is by the international community, international agencies, international governments getting interested in what is going on here and take action, drastic measures against the individual perpetrators of heinous crimes, individual perpetrators of gross violation of human rights. Kaihura has epitomized brutality in this country. The name Kaihura is synonymous with brutality, with gross violation of human rights.
Lukwago, the Kampala city mayor, is calling on the U.S. government to also sanction other top government and military officials in Uganda whom he accuses of violating human rights. Rights activist Mariam Mwiza also commended the sanctions.
Because it acts as a warning to whoever is misusing his or her public office today against the citizens' interests and generally to all government officials that today one may be absolutely powerful and tomorrow absolutely helpless.
General Kaihura issued a statement this weekend claiming he is innocent. The embattled general served as the head of Uganda police from 2005 to 2018. The once regarded as the most powerful general in Ugandan internal security circles, Kaihura was usually accused by opposition politicians of bipartisan politics. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
A spokesperson for South Sudan's rebel SPLA-IO, led by Riek Machar, says the group is not recruiting new child soldiers. But Mabio Garande Mabio says in a situation of conflict as it is in South Sudan, the vulnerable most often seek protection from the rebels. He was reacting to allegations by the chair of the UN Commission on Human Rights in South Sudan that both the South Sudan government and the rebels have recently increased the recruitment of child soldiers. Yasmin Suka, who visited South Sudan late August, says some of the child soldiers were girls providing sexual and labor services to the fighters. Garande Mabio would not confirm or deny the allegations, but he said the SPLM-IO does not have a policy to recruit child soldiers.
I can speak from a political perspective and tell you that we don't have a policy as a movement to recruit child soldiers. But as we know, in situations of war, the vulnerable are women and children, and often they are the ones who suffer. And so sometimes you might find that the civil population might seek protection from the SPLA-IO. But we don't have a policy as a movement to recruit child soldiers.
You are protecting civilians who are running away from harm, but you are not recruiting any more child soldiers, or you cannot deny recruiting child soldiers?
Obviously, I'm not on the ground in the field, so I cannot confirm or deny, but what I can say is that as a movement, we don't have a policy to recruit child soldiers.
Your leader, Riek Machar, was in Juba last week. Are we closer to peace now?
Well, the peace is a technical issue, and our leader went to Juba in search of peace, but we have been put in such a position that the regime wants to present the SPLM, SPLA-IO as the obstacle to peace. So for the sake of finding peace and not making this be a stumbling block, our leader was courageous and went to Juba to discuss these outstanding issues, which are issues to do with the security arrangements, number of states, and other issues that are stumbling blocks in the peace process. These things are things which is necessary for us to be able to follow the provisions of the agreement
and bring about fundamental change in our country. If we are forced, like last time, to form a government with the idea that we will just standing issues after the government is formed, then we would be returning to the status quo until July 2015, when we were forced to form the government and war broke out while the first vice president and the vice president were discussing the reservation in the state house.
I don't know if I should say that I'm encouraged by what you're saying, but I hear you say many times that if we are forced, does the SPLA-IO feel that as November comes closer, you are being forced to reach a peace deal informing the government?
I don't feel that as a movement we are being forced. The agreement has to be a compromise. But the problem comes when there is no punitive measure from whoever does not implement the agreement. And so if we are being forced means that the provisions of the agreement are not being followed, and then we are told to still form a government. When there are certain provisions which should have happened, like, for example, you have to form the parliament first, the revitalized parliament has to be reconstituted, the constitution has to be amended before the government is formed. So if all these things are not done before, then it's a bad sign for the agreement. What I am saying has nothing to do with the provisions of the agreement being bad. But the problem is comes in when we don't follow the provisions of the agreement and we rely on the speech to come in some kind of supernatural way.
Mambio Garande. Mambio is the chair of the Rebel SPLM-IO National Committee for Information and Public Affairs. He was speaking with us from East Africa. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, September 17th. Daybreak Africa time is 17 minutes past the hour. The spokesperson for Botswana's main opposition umbrella for democratic change has rejected calls by President Mogwesi Masisi for all political parties to sign a peace accord before the October 23rd elections. Moti Mwasa says the president cannot be trusted after abandoning the all-party conference established to resolve election-related challenges. However, supporters of the ruling party said the president's call is a step in the right direction to ensure peace during and after the election. Opposition spokesman Moti Mwasa tells reporter Peter Clotty that the calls are a strong indication that President Masisi and his ruling party would lose the upcoming elections.
Well, if indeed the president was serious about such an initiative, he said this was the first thing that she had done was approach us directly rather than announce that in a quarter meeting. The other thing is that we can no longer trust the president. He knows that he is losing and he's trying to negotiate a deal for himself, the next deal for him. We are not interested in that. What we are interested in is making sure that he delivers a free and fair election. But as it is right now, he's not been able to come to the party in terms of making sure that we have a free and fair election. Recently, he reconvened the all-party conference, a body that allows parties to discuss issues of concern regarding democracy running of elections. But out of nowhere, they decided to just suspend it and another way into elections. Like issues that should have been addressed prior to elections. They dominate in the airways in terms of the state media and are not allowing opposition parties to equal access to state media. There is no funding of the work for political parties. These are the issues that we have thought would be raised and dealt with before the coming election.
Botswana has always had credible and transparent elections. So why is the opposition umbrella group, your group, complaining about a possible election that cannot be free and fair? Why are you calling on the president to ensure that the elections are free and fair?
We've always had free elections that are not fair. Fair in the sense that the government or the ruling party has used the incumbency to raise funds and have an edge over the opposition parties. And you cannot say that is fair. And over the years, we've pushed for funding of political parties. Secondly, the Ombudsman's report, the SADC electoral observation in the last election, observed that indeed the ruling party dominates the news in the state media. So, therefore, you cannot say you have free and fair elections. Even the IEC, the Independent Electoral Commission, is not independent.
You were quoted in the local media saying President Masisi is not a man of his word. What has trust got to do with signing a pledge to ensure your supporters maintain the peace, irrespective of how the outcome of the elections go?
I don't know why the need has just arisen for such a fact. You always go into elections without such a fact. The question is why? Are we saying that we don't have the proper legal framework to take care of what's going to take place in the elections. We don't think so. I think it's just a question of one trying to protect himself and endearing himself to opposition in the building up to the opposition as a way of trying to cut a deal for himself. That is not what we're interested in. We are saying we are going to these elections under hostile and difficult conditions, where even recently you have a situation whereby the plane that was used by the president of this republic was grounded on over 3 minutes. Why then the last elections, the president of the UDC was able to fly a chopper in his campaign? So this time is very difficult under my system. The opposition is being harassed.
My question is, we understand that there are efforts to have an alliance of all opposition parties before the election. How credible is this? And will your party, the umbrella UDF, have any other alliance? Is this feasible before the elections?
I don't see that being feasible. That is why the BTF is talking about strategic alliance. They are fielding candidates in constituencies where they feel the UDC is not strong enough to surrender those constituencies from the DDP. And they are not fielding candidates in constituencies where they believe we have a better chance of arresting the seat from the ruling party. So we do not really have an alliance, strategic alliance. The former president is on record as endorsing our amendments. But we expect that from everybody. Although the UDC was premised on bringing together or galvanizing the opposition against the ruling party.
Muti Mowasa is the spokesman for Botswana's main opposition umbrella for democratic change. He spoke with U.S. Peter Clotty from the capital, Habaruni. Liberian Vice President Juho Howard Taylor says the low level of women representation in parliament in the West African region, especially Liberia, is due to poor preparation. Vice President Taylor expressed disappointment that women, who constitute a majority of the voting populations, are the least represented in governments. She spoke to reporter Moses Gaziewu in Monrovia during a one-day dialogue for women groups in Liberia on the sidelines of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS Parliament Women Legislative Caucus.
I think plenty. Because there's no way if you want to get in politics, you can just get up one day and say, this is what I want to do. Men are already beginning to prepare for 2020, putting themselves together, going around, visiting, telling people, oh, I'm interested, while the women are still sitting and deciding, you know, what they want to do. Most women aren't even members of political parties. And the thing is, political parties drive the electoral process. Which political party are they joining? All of those things we must begin to think about. Because it's easier if you join a political party than if you go independent. We must sit around the table, look at all of our challenges, and work towards them. I think we can do better.
Madam Vice President, there's one senator in the Liberian Senate, and there are a few female in the House of Representatives. Are you satisfied with the level of representation women are getting in Liberia?
Well, the first thing is, if women make up more than 50% of the votes, we actually decide who we elect. That means that we have much more to do. We have to engage women across the country. We have to ensure that we represent their interests. We have to make sure that the things that they want to see are done. So I think it's a process, and it's not an encouraging number, but it can get better if all of us put our ideas together. And this is what this whole engagement is all about.
Today you convene Women in Politics in Liberia alongside members of the ECOWAS Parliament Women Legislative Caucus. How was it? How did it go?
I think it was a very engaging program. The time was not quite enough for us to get into the depths of the issues. But then again, as our Nigerian counterpart reminded us, women, if they are serious, can sit around a table and discuss what their issues are and find a way forward. And that we have to get involved and stop sitting on the sidelines.
What does this kind of gathering brings to the table for women in politics, especially from your country, Liberia?
Well, I think the first thing it does, it shows by example that other women are doing great things in their countries, in their communities. So we should, you know, not always look at what the negatives are, but what are the positive things we can get together and bring together to work to make our own situation better. So it shows by example. And you know, women learn by seeing, by doing. I think a visit like this, showing that women in other countries are also gathering to do, you know, what is needed to uplift their societies, we too can do the same. It encourages us. It shows us that we must put in place a plan, program, financing, funding for what we need. And hopefully we can do great things here in Liberia.
That's Liberian Vice President Juho Howard Taylor speaking with reporter Moses Gaziewu in Monrovia. Sierra Leone President Julius Maada Bio announced measures Monday to curtail the rash of school examination cheating in the country. The president said examination malpractice destroys the soul of the country's educational system. He said anyone caught or suspected of examination malpractice would be prosecuted, and that any teacher or school head caught and prosecuted will be terminated from service. Alpha Osmar Timbu is Sierra Leone's Minister of Education.
The president had introduced the free quality school education program, and a considerable amount of resources he has injected, including making 21% of the national budget go towards education. So the cost, the system itself, has to do with quality. The president emphasized that measures would have to be taken place to ensure that the certificates that are given to our pupils and students have the merit that it deserves. So therefore, he said he was not going to tolerate that particular aspect during his administration. He pointed out that all those that are going to be caught, whether it's a teacher, a parent, or a principal, those have to face the full penalty of the law.
You know, I was reading somewhere where someone wrote an article that this whole thing about cheating on exams has permeated the society to the point that students are not working hard, saying perhaps teachers, parents, and everybody have some blame in this.
Of course, this is very clear. The society has to be blamed in entirety, because this is something that we have vigorously tried to pursue to ensure that when the president says quality, we mean quality. It has been persistent over the years, but then we have not taken the bold step that the administration has taken now to ensure that this aspect is being brought to an end.
Minister, you and I, we talked the other day about how students from Sierra Leone did poorly on the WAET. How do you square with this fighting against examination fraud and the students failing the WAET? Any connection?
There is. Of course, it is the measures that government have put in place that is responsible for this. You know, robust monitoring system was put in place by the government to make sure that those that are taking the examinations do so with a transparent manner. So that is why we experienced the situation that people refer to as massive failure. Although I told people the other day that some of those that took the examinations, they've never expected this kind of robust measures that government took this time to ensure that sanity is brought back to the system. And that is going to continue. Like the president emphasized, he said, it is going to continue unabated. We're going to strengthen the system more and more to make sure that at the end of the day, the quality of our education system is back to those days that we used to be referred to as the Athens of West Africa.
I get what the president is saying, but I will call for monitoring the process in the education system. Since you're Minister of Education, how would you monitor, say, any exam being given and the teachers?
With different measures that we have utilized. For instance, the West African Examination Council is in charge with the responsibility of supervising the exam, conducting the examination. They have their own invigilators, they have their supervisors. What the government did this time was to hire its own additional monitors to be able to give a third party support to the entire process. So that was just one. Then the second strategy that we utilized was to introduce conference marking, where those that are responsible for marking the examination papers do so in a conference setting. They are not allowed to take the papers back home, and this time it was concentrated in one location, so it helps to sanitize the system.
Alpha Osmar Timbo, Sierra Leone's Minister of Education, you are speaking with us from London. And that's it for this Tuesday, September 17 edition of Daybreak Africa. I'm James Butty in Washington.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, migrants from Nigeria, Ethiopia, Zambia, and Kenya have been the target of personal attacks, and their businesses have been looted. Xenophobia in South Africa on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Thank you.
Thank you.